He studies the pill bottle a long, hard time. He and I both know there are only two pills left, and the math is easy. Finally, he heaves a sigh and stands. "I'm sorry," he says softly, "but we're through with these." "No, wait!" I call after him, but he leaves the room without turning back. Chapter 25. I can't get to sleep. I'm nauseous, shaky, sweaty one minute, goosebumpy the next, and I am in pain. I cry and I moan, and when my mother comes in, I beg her to talk to my dad. "Please, Mom, they cut off my leg. Doesn't he understand? It hurts." She cries with me, but in the end, she sides with my dad. "It's a narcotic, honey. It's very addictive. You don't want to get dependent on it." "But you've got to give me something." She comes back with Tylenol. "It does nothing for the pain or the sweats or chills. I feel abandoned, angry, raw. But way, way down inside, I know they're right." Chapter 26. I've been off the meds for a few days now, which I know is good, but I'm still feeling so down. Except for Fiona, the calls have stopped, and Kaylee and her friends have found a new place to hang out. I spend a lot of time noticing how my purple paisley bedspread clashes with the oriental rug. I spend a lot of time reliving my last race, wishing for my leg back, crying. I long for my own room. My own room with four full walls and a door that closes. I'm sick of watching TV. The bookshelf is full of Mom's favorite thrillers, but I can't seem to get into any of them. I should be catching up on my homework, but it seems so overwhelming and pointless. What do I care about simplifying rational expressions? I try to hide it, but Mom knows I'm feeling trapped inside this wide-open room. I say no to almost anything she suggests, so it's not her fault, it's mine. Knowing this doesn't help, though. Yes still comes out no. She keeps me company when she can, but she's been busy running errands for my dad, plus keeping the books and doing the billing. She's the business end of Dad's handyman service, and since Dad has an aversion to paperwork, things would be completely disorganized without her. Tonight, she sits with me before bed and sighs softly. "Is there anything I can do for you?" I shake my head. I can't seem to look her in the eye, and it makes me mad at myself. She strokes my hair. "I love you, Jessica." My chin quivers. "I love you too, Mom." "Maybe it would help to have Kaylee sleep down here with you? I'm sure she'd..." "No," I tell her. "I'll be fine." I hate that it comes out angry. She's quiet a moment, then whispers, "Things will get better. I promise you, they will." I nod, but I still don't believe it. Even though things are better than they were. I've been to PT twice and back to see Dr. Wells once. Everyone's very impressed. They all say how great I'm doing. And I'm moving around better. My stump still hurts, especially since I've been off the meds. But this morning I noticed a real improvement when I went through the massage and desensitizing routine. The rough towel treatment didn't seem so rough. I found I could massage harder. So why am I being so cranky? "I'm sorry I'm being like this," I manage. "I think I'm just tired." "Remember," she says after a moment, "every day is another day closer to getting your new leg." She kisses me on the forehead and stands. "You heard Dr. Wells today. He says you're healing very quickly." I nod and force a smile. "I know." Then I settle in for the night while she gets the lights just right and eases out. And I do sleep for about 2 hours. Then, at 11:04, I wake up really having to use the bathroom. I try to ignore it, but there's no going back to sleep. So I get out of bed and hop down the hallway, but as I near the bathroom, I hear a sound. It's soft, unfamiliar. I pass the bathroom door and continue toward the kitchen. Hop, hop, hop. I brace myself against the entry and see my mom with her head buried in her arms, weeping at the table. Hop, hop, hop. I lower myself into the chair next to her and about give her a heart attack. "Jessica!" she gasps, sitting up, revealing the family photo album under her arms. She tries to close it, but I take it from her. And for the first time in weeks, I see my right leg. My whole right leg. Gold shorts, royal blue singlet, 3 medals around my neck, and 2 legs. 2 strong, smooth, and furiously fast legs. She tries to pull the picture away, but I anchor it and stare at my legs. And after a full minute of staring, I close the album and shove it to the side. I want to say something, but I can't find the words, and neither can she. All we can do is wrap our arms around each other and hold on tight. Part 2. Headwind. Chapter 1. Sherlock nudges me awake at 5:45, just like he has every morning since I started running with him. "No, boy," I tell him, "no." He whimpers, licks my face, and waits, his tail sweeping across the floor. Sherlock's bed was moved from the kitchen into the family room, and at first it was hard because he wouldn't leave my stump alone. He knew something was wrong, different. He would sniff it or try to get near it to check it out. Thankfully, he's over that now and just spends his time hanging out with me. I love him so much. He is always good, faithful company. But at 5:45 every morning, he makes me cry, especially when he wakes me from the running dream. Sherlock whines softly and my eyes begin to burn, but then I remember my mother crying at the table, and the stinging is replaced by a flush of adrenaline, of anger. Not at the guy who crashed into our bus, not at God, at me. I swing my legs over the edge of the bed and give Sherlock a kiss on the muzzle. "Where's your ball, boy?" He scrambles across the room, fetches it from his bed, and drops it in my lap. I'm already wearing the sweatpants Mom shortened on the right side. They're quick and comfortable, and I don't have to deal with a floppy pant leg. My sweatshirt is within reach, so getting dressed is easy. And really, Sherlock deserves better than what I've been delivering. I pull on the sweatshirt, slip into a shoe, rake my hair into a ponytail. Sherlock spins in a circle and barks. "Shh," I whisper. "Just the ball, okay?" I put the tennis ball in front of his face so he's clear about what we're doing before I let him out. He wags and pants, and when I'm pretty sure we have an agreement, I ease open the front door and hop out after him. He waits for me at the bottom of the porch steps. "Good boy," I tell him, and then set up to throw the ball across the front yard. It's not a big yard, so it would help if I could go into one corner and throw to the other, but I didn't bring a crutch, and with Mom's flower beds the way they are, there's nothing I can use for support. So I just toss the ball from beside the pipe railing and teach Sherlock to put the ball in my hand instead of at my feet. My foot. He has fun, and when I'm worn out, I sit on the porch step and pet him and tell him he's a good, good boy. It's peaceful out, and for a moment I enjoy sitting with Sherlock, sharing the morning. But then I hear something. Something that makes my heart leap, then crash to the pit of my stomach. I don't want to hear this. Don't want to see it. Still, I can't turn away. Sherlock's ears perk. He stops panting and stares out at the sidewalk, too, so I hold on to his collar, afraid that he'll bolt off the porch. And then there he is, in light gray sweats, lost in his own rhythmic world. A runner. Chapter 2. I bumped into Kaylee on the way back inside. She barely grunts hello. "Good morning to you, too," I tell her as she goes past me again with a pair of jeans out of the dryer. She stops in her tracks and turns to face me. "You're criticizing me for being grumpy?" "Well, you just blast by me like I'm not even here." "So, I'm supposed to be a mind reader?" "What's that supposed to mean?" She puts a hand on her hip. "Look, you act like you hate everyone and everything. You never talk. What do you want from me?" I look from side to side. A little civility? "Nice idea," she says, pounding up the stairs. "Why don't you try it?" I stand there for a good 5 minutes, stunned. I want to shout, "Why don't you try losing a leg and see what it's like?" I want to chase her up the stairs and yell at her for being bratty and unfeeling and just wrong. Instead, I go back to bed and hug Lucas the bear, and when Mom leaves to take Kaylee to school, I pretend to be asleep. When they're gone, I'm relieved. Dad's already left for a job, so I have the house to myself. Me, myself, and my thoughts. At first, I'm glad to be alone. I don't have to pretend to be fine. But I can't seem to get Kaylee's words out of my head. Soon, I feel anchored to my bed, caged in this wide-open room. The phone rings, and when I check caller ID, I see that it's Fiona's cell. I almost don't answer, but at the last minute, I punch talk. "Are you ready?" she asks. "I'm on my way over to pick you up." She says the same thing every morning. "No," I answer, just like every morning. "Oh, come on, Jessica," she says with a sigh. "You can't put it off forever." "Watch me," I grumble. There's just the hum of traffic for a minute. Then she says, "Do your parents realize how depressed you are?" I'm quiet. Crippled, depressed, what's the difference? "Look, you need to get out of there. We're on a half day today, so get ready, because I am coming over after school. I don't care what you say, you're getting in my car, and we're going out for lunch. I'll take you to Angelo's." "I can't," I tell her. "I'm a mess." "Yeah, you're a mess, and we're going to fix that. Expect me. I'll be there at around 1. "No, I mean," she hangs up, and I'm left staring at the phone. How can she possibly expect me to go out? How can she expect me to deal with any of it? First Kaylee and now Fiona? Why don't they get it? Besides, I couldn't go out even if I wanted to. I haven't had a real shower since the morning of the wreck. They tried once in the hospital, but that was more awkward than effective. And now that I'm home, I've been getting by with the haphazard sponge baths, but my hair has only been washed once. The only part of me that gets daily attention is my stump. Massage, desensitize, clean, dry, dress. Twice a day. Every day. The rest of me feels matted and mangy and gross. Yesterday, Mom offered to wash my hair in the sink again, but I told her, maybe tomorrow. And besides the obvious slipping hazards of a one-legged shower, there doesn't happen to be a shower downstairs. Just a half bathroom, a toilet, and a sink. Fiona knows all this, so how can she expect me to go out? I know she means well, but she obviously doesn't understand what I'm going through. So I'm a little mad, a little in a state of disbelief. And between Kaylee's snippy comments and Fiona insisting I go to Angelo's, I get agitated and start hopping around. I hop out of my wide open room, hop over to the kitchen, hop all over the place. It's as close to pacing as I can come. Finally, I find myself at the base of the stairs. I stare up the long flight of steps. I count the treads. 14, including the top landing. 14 hard hops up. I'm not sure I can do it. I'm not sure I should even try. It seems an ominous stretch, and I'm already tired from all my senseless hopping around. But up those ominous 14 steps is a shower. A hot, massaging shower. I think about getting a crutch, but I'd have to hop clear back to the family room for that. So I grab the handrail with both hands instead. One hop. Two hops. Three. I rest, looking up at 11 more steps, then take a deep breath. Four hops. Five hops. Six. My arms are doing a lot of the work, pulling me up as I hop. I'm panting, so I take a minute to rest, telling myself I'm almost halfway. Then I press on. Seven steps. Eight. My good leg is shaking, and I feel a little dizzy, so I turn around and sit. I'm past halfway, I tell myself, almost there. And then I discover something wonderful. By sitting down, I've gained two steps. My foot is on step eight, but I'm sitting on step 10. I put my hands down on the tread behind me, raise my foot to step 9, and push myself up backwards. I'm sitting on 11. I push up to 12, to 13. My right thigh is burning from holding up my stump as I push one more time. Then I grab the handrail, hoist myself up, and take a final hop. I look down at the run of stairs and feel an overwhelming sense of triumph. I'm upstairs. Chapter 3. Our shower is a combination shower bathtub with sliding glass doors, so I can't just push aside a door and hop in. I have to get myself over the side of the tub. I know from my experience in the hospital that it helps to have some sort of seat when I shower, so I take a little collapsible step stool that's stored behind the bathroom door and place it inside the tub, opened up. It's got rubber feet and rubber-coated steps, so it seems like it'll be secure enough. And even though the rest of the step stool is metal, I don't think Mom will mind me exposing it to rusting hazards. After it's in place, I get everything ready. Then I stand outside the shower and put my hands here, there, all over the place. I can't figure out how to get over this hurdle, and it makes me mad. The opening's not wide enough for me to sit on the curb and swing in. I can't step over or hop over. How can this be so hard? I find myself thinking, why couldn't I have lost an arm instead? If I'd lost an arm, this wouldn't be a problem. I could step right over this curb. If I'd lost an arm, I could run circles in the shower. I could run up and down stairs. I could run. It's useless to think this, though. So finally, I grab the overhead door brace with my hands facing each other, one beside the other. I swing my stump over the side of the tub and stand straddling the curb, trying to figure out the next step of this obstacle course. After a few false starts, I finally use my arms to help me hop up onto the curb. The door guide is sharp against my foot, but I manage to pivot on it, then hop down into the tub. I sit on a step stool, feeling a mixture of triumph and frustration, but when the water rains down on me, I am washed all over with relief. It feels so nice to just sit here. I could sit like this all day. Eventually, I pick up the soap, and as I'm sudsing the washcloth, it crosses my mind that it would be hard to soap up with just one hand. I try, and it is. It's very awkward. I start paying attention to all my movements, how one arm complements the other, and I start thinking about everything I do with two hands, driving, golfing, keyboarding. Even writing really takes two hands. The pen's held in one, the paper's anchored with the other. My mind wanders all over everyday things. Opening a water bottle, getting dressed, making a sandwich, washing dishes. I imagine life with only one hand and realize that it would be hard. In a different way, but still hard. I squeeze shampoo into my left hand, then put down the bottle with my right. I rub my hands together, spreading out the soap. And as I massage both sides of my head, I am thankful for my hands. Thankful to have both of them. Chapter 4. Mom freaks out when she comes home. I don't know this because I'm rinsing my hair, thinking about arms and legs, and if I had a choice about which limb I had to give up, what would I choose? Jessica! She gasps when she finds me. I turn off the water as she rushes over to the tub. She's got a phone with her and says she's in the shower into it, then clicks off. Did Fiona help you? She asks. I do a mock look around. Do you see Fiona anywhere? You should not have come up here by yourself. She's looking very stern. What if you had... I'm fine, I tell her, and stretch way out to snag the towel. And clean. I give her a smile, and I feel absurdly proud of myself. After I tousle my hair with the towel, I dry the rest of me and stand, wrapping the towel snugly around me. Then I grab the top brace of the door frame and shoo my mother back. The door guide hurts again as I hop onto the tub wall, but I'm showing off now, so I act like it's no big deal. Wow, she says when I'm standing on the other side. She's blinking at me. It's like she's just discovered her daughter is Wonder Woman. And for a moment, I feel like I am. How did you get upstairs? She asks. I tell her about my little adventure and assure her that it was safe and that I was never in danger of tumbling to my death. And I'm convincing her that my little sit-and-scoot method will be even easier going downstairs than it was coming up when I realize that my dresser's in the family room and I have no clean clothes with me. Scooting downstairs in nothing but a towel seems like a very bad idea. I'll get them, Mom offers in an overly hyper way, and she's already speed-dialing my dad as she exits the bathroom. Hey, I call, hopping over and leaning out into the hallway. No sweats, okay? I'm going out to lunch with Fiona. What? She stops in her tracks and whispers to my dad. She's going out to lunch with Fiona. I smile and hop back into the bathroom, wondering when I decided that and how in the world I can be feeling this good. Chapter 5. Fiona shows up a little before 1 o'clock. Mom's anxious because I want to take the crutches, not the wheelchair. What if you fall? She asks. Her lack of confidence annoys me. I know how to fall, Mom. They taught me, remember? But what if you really fall? What if... Stop it! I'll be fine. She bites back her worry and watches from the family room window as I hop, swing, and hobble out to the curb and into Fiona's hand-me-down Subaru Outback. Phew, I say when I'm situated inside. Fiona puts the key in the ignition but doesn't start the car. We're really going out to lunch, she says, smiling at me like she can't quite believe I'm finally back in the passenger seat. And you look great. What did you do to your hair? It's so shiny. I laugh. I washed it. She laughs too and turns the key. That's all? I guess it's happy with me, huh? She pulls away from the curb. More like ecstatic. I roll down the window and wave at my mom, who's still watching from inside. She waves back, but even from the curb, I can feel her worry. And I suddenly realize that it has nothing to do with the wheelchair or with me falling. The last time Fiona drove me away in her Subaru, it took me more than a week to come home. And not all of me made it. Can I borrow your phone? I ask Fiona. Mine was a casualty of the wreck. She hands it over, and I dial the house. I'm fine, I tell my mother when she picks up. Don't worry, okay? You keep telling me I should get up and out, and now I am, so you should be happy. I am, she says. But her voice is choked. Mom, I say softly. You want me to do this. I know I do, she says. And she's trying hard not to, but I can tell she's crying. I'll call you from Angelo's, okay? Thanks, she says, then gives me a cheery, have fun, all right? I don't know about that, but I do plan to eat a lot of lasagna. She laughs and we hang up. And after I've closed Fiona's phone, I stare at it and try to sort through what I'm feeling. Mom's been so strong through all of this, so positive. I, on the other hand, have been stormy and dark and defeated. And now suddenly she's falling apart and I'm telling her everything's okay. It's like she's reached the end of her leg of the relay. She gave it her all. She's exhausted, collapsing. I know what that feels like. And I know what this means. It's my turn to hold the baton. Chapter 6. Somehow I wind up standing at Angelo's crowded foyer for nearly 20 minutes while half a dozen two-legged people sit. Unbelievable, Fiona whispers as we finally follow the hostess to a table. What is wrong with people? It's okay, I tell her, but I'm relieved to be seated. Relieved to have left the foyer and the awkward glances of a mom who wouldn't actually look at me and her kid who wouldn't stop. We open our menus, but it's just a formality. I'm getting the lasagna. She's getting the eggplant parmesan. Oh, she says, snapping her menu closed. They've added mandarin chicken salad to the lunch menu. They have? I ask, searching the menu. She laughs. No, not here. At school. The waiter returns shortly to take our orders, and when he's gone, I sip my water and ask, so what else is new at school? Fiona's eyes get wide. I never ask about school. I hate hearing about it, hate thinking about it. I break out in a cold sweat every time she starts chatting about it. She reaches across the white tablecloth and nearly knocks over the single carnation centerpiece as she grabs my wrist. You're coming back? Really? You're ready? She bounces in her seat. Finally, finally, finally! I look down. I don't know if I'll ever be ready, I glance at her, but I think I'm ready to try. She bounces again, saying, tomorrow would be perfect. It's Friday, one day, then the weekend. You can get your feet wet, you know? Her cheeks flush and she covers her mouth with her hand. Don't worry about it, I tell her, then shake my head. But tomorrow? The thought sends me into a panic. Look, she says softly, you can put it off, but that'll just make it worse. I think about this, about what Kaylee said, about how I've pushed away everyone I know because I'm always thinking no. Finally, I give a little nod and say, it would only be one day, and then I'd have all weekend to get over people staring or ignoring or putting their foot in their mouth. I grin at her. Yeah, that too. So, is this a yes? I take a deep breath. This is a maybe yes. Fiona laughs. That's a big improvement over absolutely no. The waiter brings some steaming bread, which I'm happy to dive into. So, I say, catch me up. Fiona grabs some bread. Oh, well, first off, everyone misses you. They ask me every day how you're doing. Really? It comes out quiet, like I'm hurt, which I guess I kind of am. Fiona leans forward. Of course they do. I shrug. She frowns a little. When you're gloomy and won't talk to people, they don't know what to do, okay? It's not their fault. I look away. I know. So, yes, everyone misses you and asks about you and wants to know when you're coming back. She eyes me and says, Gavin asked about you at least 3 times. Gavin? I shake my head. Why? Does he need more information for his story? He seems sincere, but her voice trails off and she scowls. But what? She shakes her head. Just tell me. She takes a deep breath, then blurts. Meryl's managed to work her magic on him. I feel myself flush. They're going out? She rolls her eyes, frowns, rips apart her bread, and then she nods. After I compose myself, I say, "Look, get real. He wasn't interested in me when I had two legs." "What's that matter? You're the same person." "No," I think as I sip my water, "I'm not." "Well, forget about him," she says. "What do you want to know about?" This is a good question, and it's one I really don't have an answer to. I want to know everything about school, and nothing about it. It hurts to realize how unnecessary I am. From what little I've let Fiona tell me, school life seems the same as always. Track meets happen. The same flitty people are still flitting about. The same teachers are keeping to their same routines. The same lunchtime activities and rallies and club meetings still take place. I fell off, but the merry-go-round keeps moving. Lucy died, but the merry-go-round keeps moving. Still, as much as this thinking upsets me, I'm starting to see that I need the merry-go-round much more than it needs me. And in the end, my choice is to hop back on or get left in the dust. So I take a deep breath and ask about the one thing that means the most to me. The one thing I absolutely don't want to hear about. "How's track?" All her little fidgeting motions stop. She studies me a moment and then says, "We lost to Mount Vernon by 6 points. They swept the 400 and won the 4x400. It lost us the meet." I have a twinge of comfort. Maybe the merry-go-round at least slowed down with me gone. "Did Marcy pick up my leg?" I ask. Her mouth drops open and she blinks at me. I blink too, realizing what I've just said. I meant my leg of the relay. "I know what you meant," she says, and her face is twitching all over the place. I snicker, then blurt out, "Did she pick up my leg?" And suddenly we're both hysterical. I wipe my eyes with my napkin, and somewhere inside me, I can feel a shift. I'm turning a corner, leaving one long, hard section of track behind me. I smile at Fiona. It feels so, so good. Chapter 7. After lunch, Fiona helps me organize the homework that she's continued to collect for me. 6 classes, 3 weeks. It's a daunting amount of work. But Fiona's upbeat and optimistic, and since we have 5 out of 6 classes together, she's very familiar with the assignments. "You know what?" she says, after she's helped me make a checklist for each of the courses. "There's no reason you should have to do all those assignments. Some of them are total busy work." "So what are you saying?" "I'm saying that tomorrow we'll ask every teacher which assignments they'll let you slide on." She shakes her head. "Look how much you have to do. This is crazy." "So I shouldn't do any of them yet?" She thinks a minute, then says, "Start with the math. But only do the odds, you know, half of them. You can check your answers in the back of the book, and if you're getting it, just move on." I frown. I don't know if Miss Rucker's going to go for that. "If she doesn't, she's ridiculous. Tell her to lose a leg and come back with all her homework done." Mom comes into the family room. "Who are we discussing?" Fiona and I exchange glances. "Ms. Rucker," Fiona grumbles. "She's such a machine." "That's your math teacher, right?" Mom's trying to be casual, but she's beside herself that I'm organizing my schoolwork. She's had several conversations with my counselor about me making up work and returning to school, but I have been a complete brick wall about it. "Is there anything I can do to help?" she asks brightly. I shake my head. "I think we've got things under control." "How about some drinks then? Apple juice, water, soda, Gatorade?" "Apple juice," Fiona and I say together. And when Mom leaves, Fiona puts aside my newly organized binder and sets me up with paper, pencil, and my math book. "You want to get going on that while I park right here and do my homework?" Yes, ma'am, I say with a laugh, because it's obvious she's not going to take no for an answer. We work diligently, and I make good progress, especially with Fiona tutoring me through the math problems. And even though I'm having no trouble concentrating, I'm surprised to catch Fiona spacing out a couple of times. The third time I notice it, I ask, "What are you thinking about?" She says, "Huh?" then flutters off some answer that makes very little sense. "What?" Just then, Mom comes into the room and asks Fiona to stay for dinner, but Fiona says, I can't. I've got to get home. Tons to do. I want to ask, like, what? But in the back of my mind, I'm getting the picture. Fiona's planning cupcakes and streamers and banners, loudspeaker announcements and music. She's planning my return to school. In a flash, Fiona has packed up and is whirlwinding out of the room. "I will be here a little after 7 tomorrow morning," she says, pointing at me. "Be ready." Then she darts from the room. Mom chases after her and catches her out on the walkway, and now it's my turn to watch through the window. Mom hugs her, holds her cheeks. They talk and laugh and hug again, and then Fiona's hurrying to her car and Mom's waving goodbye. "She is one amazing friend," my mother says as she comes back into the family room. I nod. "You're really lucky to have her." I nod again. And I would say more, but once again, I'm overwhelmed. This time, in a good way. Chapter 8. I can't sleep. I've got a mixture of butterflies and panic. So I get up, get my history book, and start reading. Eventually, it puts me to sleep. "Sweetheart," my mother whispers, softly shaking my shoulder. I turn a groggy eye toward the clock. 5:45. I definitely need more sleep. My mind stumbles to a comforting conclusion. I can always try going back to school later, like Monday or Tuesday or next Friday or... "Jessica!" Mom's shaking my shoulder again. I will her to go away, but I'm too tired to project much resistance. "I know," I murmur, but somewhere in the fog of my mind, I'm aware that I don't know what I know. Whatever it is, can't be much. "Were you up all night reading?" "A lot of it," I murmur. She takes the history book off the bed. "Homework is not that important," she scolds. I grunt, then hide under the covers. I just want to sleep, escape. "Jessica," she says gently, pulling the covers off my head, "it's important that you go to school today." "I'm too tired," I tell her, and pull a blanket over my head. And then I remember. Fiona. Fiona and her cupcakes and banners and welcome back balloons. I groan and peek out of the covers. "Please tell me she's not making a big deal out of this." Mom studies me, then lets a little smile escape. "You know her better than that." "Oh." I groan and sit up. Mom kisses me on the head. "Would a shower help?" I check the clock. It's almost 6. I don't have time. "Then I'll start on breakfast," she says, and leaves me to get myself together. I stretch out my leg and start on my morning physical therapy. It's become second nature to me. I used to do it because I had to, but now I do it because it helps me feel like I've still got a working body. Stretch, resistance, strengthen. I do both legs, both arms. I use towels, bands, and hand weights. It helps wake me up. Next, I do a quick sponge bath in the downstairs bathroom, fix my hair, then dress in a long-sleeve tee, a hoodie vest, and my softest jeans. I pin the right leg up. It makes the situation more obvious, but really there's no hiding what I'm missing, and it bugs me to have the extra fabric flopping around. You look great, Mom gushes as I hop to the kitchen table. Good morning, sweetheart, Dad says, and puts the newspaper aside. Mom's big on traditional breakfast, so there's sausage, toast, and scrambled eggs, plus orange juice and milk. Kaylee, breakfast, she calls at full volume. Kaylee, you're going to be late. I start on my breakfast and hope that Kaylee appears for more than her usual bite and run. I want to try to start over with her. Maybe tell her the picked up my leg story. But Kaylee doesn't appear. And breakfast with Dad's a little awkward. I don't know why. We small talk between pockets of silence, but it's strange. It's like he wants to say something, but he's holding back. Then, just as Kaylee's footsteps are finally pounding down the stairs, Dad asks,
"Do you think you'll see your coach today?"
I don't know. I hope so. Good, he says, but there's an edge to his voice. I rest my fork and study him. It's not his fault, Dad. Cairo's a great guy. Fiona says I might have bled to death if it wasn't for him. Dad gives a solemn nod.
I know.
Then why are you mad at him? Mom shoots him a don't-even-go-there look as Kaylee blasts into the kitchen. You really going to school? Kaylee asks. I'm trying it out, I tell her with a smile. She stops. Do that, she says, pointing at my face. Do that right there, and everything will be fine. She hugs me and whispers, I'm sorry about yesterday, in my ear. Dad uses Kaylee's interruption to beat a speedy exit, and then the doorbell rings. Gotta run, Kaylee says, gobbling down two bites of eggs and a swig of juice. I ask Mom why Dad's mad at Cairo, but she says, it's nothing for you to be concerned about. What's nothing to be concerned about? But it's not Kaylee's right at the door. It's mine. Fiona, come in, my mom calls, completely sweeping my question out of the kitchen. You ready? Fiona asks, and she's beaming with excitement. Suddenly, the butterflies are back. So is the fear. But I nod, take a deep breath, and stand. I'm really sore from all my activity yesterday, and my armpits are chafed from my trip to Angelo's. So after I brush my teeth and collect my things, I don't put up much of a fuss about using the wheelchair. Just be queen for the day, Fiona says, thinking she needs to convince me. It's a big campus, my mom chimes in. Fine, I tell them. So Fiona and my mom scurry to get me, my backpack, and the wheelchair into Fiona's car. Mom gives me a kiss and tells me, I'm so proud of you. I smile at her and close the car door, and as we pull away from the curb, I roll down the window and wave like I'm a queen on parade. She laughs. I laugh. So far, so good. Chapter 9. I'm not laughing when we pull into the student parking lot. Instead, my heart's hammering inside my chest, and I'm desperate to go home. I know I'm being irrational. Still, I am having a complete panic attack. There are already swarms of people at school. Fiona and I had planned to arrive before 7:30, but it's already 7:40. Everything takes longer with only one leg. Everything. It'll be okay, Fiona says as she pulls up the parking brake. Give me a minute. I'll be around with your throne. I'm breaking out in a cold sweat. We've only got 10 minutes to get to class. Maybe we should... We'll be fine, she calls as she zips around to the hatchback. She pulls out the collapsed wheelchair and says over the back seat, Jessica, really, this is the best thing you could be doing. You'll see, it'll be fine. I manage to hobble out of the car as she opens up the chair and wheels it over to the passenger door. There you go, she says. And I sit. I'm not used to the wheelchair. It seems too small and too big, too precarious and too safe, all at the same time. My left leg feels cramped by the footrest. My right leg feels lost at sea. The jean's leg is pinned up, and I suddenly want it down. Maybe I won't look like such a pathetic freak. I undo the safety pins while Fiona gets our backpacks. "Ready, Your Majesty?" she asks. And when I nod, she straps on her backpack and rests mine in my lap. "Then let's roll." The pant leg flaps as she hurries me toward the school entrance. Flap, flap, flap. Bothers me. Flusters me. Then totally freaks me out. "Stop!" I cry. She keeps pushing as she asks, "What's wrong?" "Stop!" She does stop and comes around to face me. "We're almost there," she says softly. "It'll be all right. I promise you. It'll be all right." I manage to choke out. My pant leg is driving me crazy. She watches me pin it back up, then asks, "You okay now?" I nod, but I'm not okay. I'm anything but okay. I know it's not my fault. I know I haven't done anything wrong. I know it's irrational, but still, I'm mortified. Mortified to be me. Chapter 10. My downward spiral is interrupted by Chandel Norwood.
"Jessica?"
she asks, coming towards us from the left.
"Jessica!"
she squeals and charges at me, her arms spread wide.
"Girl, you're back!"
she cries, smothering me in a hug. Chandel is a sophomore, is fast enough to run the 100 for varsity, and is potentially deadly with a discus. When she hits her release right, the discus soars, but once in a while she gets turned around and sends it off in the wrong direction. All of us have learned to stand clear when Chandel's spinning toward her release. I return her hug and feel a bit calmer.
"Good to see you too,"
I mumble into her shoulder. She pulls back and smiles, and then, what is there to say? It's not like I'll be going to track practice. It's not like we have anything else in common. "We've got to get moving," Fiona says after an awkward few seconds.
"Can't have her tardy on her first day back."
So Chandel waves and hurries off, and Fiona rolls me across the parking lot and around the corner to the school's entrance arch and onto campus. Fiona's moving fast and chattering away.
"We're lucky we don't go to one of those schools where everything's, like, enclosed and the halls are really crowded and you have to go up and down levels to get to class."
She's right, but what I'm thinking is, how will I do this in the rain? We enter the courtyard, and as Fiona pushes me along the sidewalk, I see the first signs that she's been a busy bee. On our right is the outdoor theater, a Greek-style semicircle of stepped cement seats going down to a stage, an area that the upper classes tend to dominate during lunchtime. Along the far wall are balloons and a large, "Welcome back, Jessica" banner. I smile over my shoulder at Fiona, and she leans forward and whispers, "Gavin helped me put it up." The warning bell rings as she hurries me along to first period. A couple of people wave and call hello, but mostly it's people shortcutting across the lawns, hurrying to beat the next bell. "You are the best friend ever," I tell her. "I love the banner." I twist around farther. "What time did you get here?" She laughs like, "Oh, you have no idea," and simply says, "Early." Liberty High is laid out like a wagon wheel with the courtyard as the hub. In the old days, the school was much smaller, but as time's gone by, more and more portable classrooms have been added to the fields behind the school. Each segment of the wheel is called a wing, and every wing is for a certain subject area and is named with a number. Math is in the 900 wing, science is in the 800 wing, English is in the 200 wing. Not the most creative, but easy to figure out. Fiona rolls me into a portable unit in the 200 wing. It's really just the educational version of a double-wide trailer, and like all the portable units, it's got a ramp. A long, zigzag ramp that's always annoyed me. It's a time killer when you're running late, a bottleneck when the release bell rings, and it's noisy. Clomp, clomp, clomp. People come up it in the middle of class to deliver messages and whatnot. It always wrecks my concentration when we're testing. Plus, it's ugly. Painted wood, pipe guardrail. Some teachers try, but there's nothing anyone can do to camouflage it. It is what it is. And what it is now is my only way into the classroom. This bothers me more than it should. When I was a freshman, my friends and I used to swing under the guardrail to get inside the classroom, leap over it to get out. It was just quicker. Teachers scolded it out of us, or maybe we just grew up. But as Fiona rolls me up the ramp, I see my options as closed. I can no longer catapult or swing or slide. I can only roll. Something about this makes me grab the wheels and push. "Careful," Fiona says. "Don't get your fingers caught." "Just let me do it," I tell her. But when she lets go, I discover that pushing myself is not easy. The motion's all forearms and triceps, and I don't seem to have much strength in them. I also can't steer very well. And by the time I've maneuvered the chair to face the second half of the ramp, I'm holding up traffic. "Go ahead," I grumble to the people waiting. And I let Fiona finish pushing me inside. And then I'm distracted by something I hadn't even considered. Where do I sit? Am I supposed to get out of the wheelchair and hop over to my regular seat? Should I stay in the wheelchair at the back of the classroom? How am I supposed to take notes? Miss Alloy comes to my rescue. "Oh, Jessica," she says, moving toward the back of the classroom. "It's so good to see you. No one seemed to know when you'd be returning." She drags an empty desk alongside my wheelchair and says, "I'll get them to deliver a table for you, but for today, will this work?" "Sure," I tell her and try to smile like everything's just dandy. "Miss Alloy," Fiona says, signaling me to get out my English assignment sheet. "Here's a list of the homework Jessica's missed. She hasn't been able to do it. I'm sure you can understand that. And now she's overwhelmed by everything she has to catch up on, so we're wondering which of these you'll excuse her from." Miss Alloy looks directly at Fiona. Fiona holds her gaze. "She has 6 classes, Miss Alloy." She shakes the list a little and says, "They're all like this." Then she gives Miss Alloy a pleading look. "There must be some leeway." Miss Alloy takes the list and smiles at me. "We'll work something out." The tardy bell has rung, so she heads to the front of the class calling, "Good morning, everybody. Let's welcome Jessica back." Everyone claps and whistles, and a couple of people even stand up. Fiona grins and gives me a wink as she moves to her assigned seat. It's a wink that means something specific. You can make it. You can do this. 1 down, 5 to go. Chapter 11. Everywhere I go, I feel like the elephant in the room. A lot of people do say hi and welcome me back, but a lot more don't. Fiona notices it too, whispering, "Maturity check," in my ear when people pretend that I'm not there. I feel myself shutting down, withdrawing. She gives me the same advice Kaylee did. "Smile," she whispers. "Be open. If you're friendly, they'll be friendly." This is not easy for me, and it seems backward. But I don't want to be treated like I'm invisible, so I try. I also try to speak for myself and ask my teachers to excuse me from some of the homework. They're all very nice about it, but what's left is still overwhelming, especially since I'm also diving into the middle of new lessons and new homework assignments. After science class is over, Mr. Vetter returns my assignment list, and I'm surprised to see that instead of having me do a big project, he's allowing me to submit a 500-word essay, and he's whittled my worksheets down to 3.
"I wish I could excuse you from all of it," he says as I'm checking it over. "What's left is the bare minimum for the curriculum." I am so relieved to be excused from the project that I gush. No, this is great. You have no idea how much this helps, Mr. Vedder. He gives me a kind smile.
I'm just glad you're back, Jessica. Anything you need, you just ask. Okay?
I nod and thank him and tell him to have a nice weekend. But as Fiona starts pushing me toward the door, he asks,
How are your parents doing with all this?
The question's quiet. Like, he's not really sure he should be asking, but can't seem to help himself. It's also the first truly personal question I've been asked all day, and an odd one because Mr. Vedder doesn't even know my parents. My skin prickles. Why is he asking me this? What business is it of his? But then my mind flashes to the pictures of his daughter, Hannah, on his desk. To his stories about Hannah catching lizards in the driveway, pranking him on April Fool's, crashing her bike and breaking her arm. Suddenly, I get it. He doesn't know my parents, but he is a parent. So I tell him the truth. It's hard, I say softly. Ups and downs, just like me. He nods, then takes a deep breath and lets it out as he says,
I can't even imagine.
On our way down Mr. Vedder's ramp, Fiona whispers,
That was awkward.
It was fine, I tell her. It's lunchtime, and I'm famished. But Fiona's not heading for the courtyard. She's steering me away from it. Hey, where are we going? I ask over my shoulder. To lunch, she says with a mischievous grin. Lunch is located in Coach Cairo's portable classroom. Lunch consists of pizza, salads, cupcakes, sodas, cookies, and licorice. Lunch is decorated with balloons and streamers and Welcome Back, Jessica, written all over the whiteboards. Lunch is a gathering of runners and friends and coaches. Surprise! They all shout and blow party horns or shower me with confetti. Lunch makes me cry. I suddenly realize how much I miss these people. It's not just running. It's the team. You guys are the best, I finally choke out, wiping the tears away. Someone starts up with, For she's a jolly good fellow, which makes absolutely no sense, but it doesn't matter. And then someone shouts, Speech, speech, like I've done something great instead of survived something awful. I shake my head and wave off that crazy idea and simply say, eat, eat. Everyone laughs and dives for food because, come on, when is a runner not hungry? As Fiona delivers me a plate with salad and a slice of pepperoni pineapple, Cairo pulls up a desk beside me and says,
You have no idea how much we've missed you.
I nod and attempt to smile. He looks grayer than I remember, older. I notice a woven green and black name bracelet tied around his wrist. The letters spell Lucy. I look away, feeling bad that I haven't spoken to him since the accident. I feel bad that he tried and I didn't, that he came to the hospital and I didn't want to see him. After 3 years of him believing in me, pushing me, tailoring my workouts, I'd become the fastest 400-meter sprinter in the league, and I never even bothered to call him back.
I'd really like to talk to you sometime, he says.
I nod. Me too. I'm sorry that I've been so shut down. He shakes his head.
Who can blame you? Jess, come on.
I look at him and blurt out, What's going on with you and my dad? He seems to weigh things in his mind, then says,
There's a tangle of insurance issues, and things are not resolving as quickly as either of us would like. I'm afraid your dad thinks I could be doing more to pressure things along, but it really is out of my hands.
It's about insurance?
He nods. It'll get straightened out, but these things can take time.
I'm baffled. My dad's been down on Cairo about insurance? How could that possibly be the coach's responsibility? But then I start wondering, so who paid for the hospital? or the ambulance, or the physical therapist, or the wheelchair, or the crutches, or the shrinker socks, or the anything. Before this, it never even crossed my mind. I thought it was just taken care of. "Hey," he says, standing, "I sure didn't mean to put a damn